the worst thing imaginable for a mother. Her son snatched one early morning, never to be seen again. But today, Noreen Ghosh has come to terms with how hard she has fought for her little boy. Episode 61 of Crime Over Wine starts right now. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Crime Over Wine, the only podcast with head-scratching true crime stories that are just better over a bottle of wine. I'm your host, Liam Collins, and this week, my guest co-host is one of my favorite human beings on the face of the earth. She's a Chattanoogan, a badass businesswoman, and a true crime fanatic as well. My guest co-host this week is Megan McLean. Hello, Megan.
Hi, Liam. How are you doing?
I am so good. It's so good to see you. And I'm so happy to have you on finally, because Megan, I think we like first got connected like when I first started the podcast just about, because I don't even remember how exactly we got in touch. But I am very excited to have you on because I first found out about you because you were messaging me about the podcast.
Oh my gosh, I know. Well, I was fangirling really hard. So I found the podcast and then we met like in person when you did your first live show at Amadas.
Yes.
And so I came to that with my husband and it was so fun. And then obviously with the wine, you can't go wrong.
Right. It's a good combo.
And then I just remember there was one episode where you like partnered with Queers and Beers. Is that it?
Yeah. Beers with Queers. Yeah.
The Beers with Queers
podcast. Mm-hmm.
And you did this stupid, infuriating cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And
so I had to go to
their platform. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I had to go to their platform and hear the second episode. And I was like, ugh, this guy knows what he's doing.
I do remember you messaging me at the end of that first episode saying I forgot what you said, but you were pissed. You were so mad about the cliffhanger.
I was so angry. Also, I have zero shame online for anybody who has interacted with me on social media. It's like, yes, I will DM you and tell you exactly what I thought about your podcast episode. And so that's how we kind of met. And then obviously, I've come to all of your live shows. I'm a huge true crime fan because I mean, as basic as one can get. And so I've been doing, I know, thank you. I am the basicest. And so I've been obsessed with true crime. And then obviously to find a local Chattanoogan podcast about crime and wine. And then the fact that you described me as a Chattanoogan, because I moved here in 2015. And so I always say, I have driven the W road, so that makes me a native.
Oh, yeah, and survived.
Yes, correct. Exactly. And so it's been almost 10 years, and I've driven the W road, so I'm officially a Chattanoogan.
Well, there you go. Officially graduated. Love that for you. Well, I'm just so happy to have you here because I love you so stinking much. And so let's drink some wine together for the umpteenth time or for however many times we've done that since we've known each other in a very short period of time. So this week we are drinking Vivir Sin Dormir, a red blend for people who love dancing in the moonlight, living life to the fullest, and having fun until daybreak. It has intense aromas of red and black fruits like plum, blackberry, and raspberry notes, and full-bodied power on the palate, but delightfully balanced but silky tannins. It has a long and lingering finish that will absolutely having you craving the next sip. That is probably the most elaborate description I've ever read on this podcast.
Also very accurate though. Okay, so listen, I'm an equal opportunity consumer when it comes to wine. I love all wine. I do love a good red. Talk to me about tannins and if it's got a lot of tannins. Yeah. Like, what does that even mean? Will you educate me a little bit?
Yeah. Oh, gladly. Absolutely. 100%. So tannins are basically like the almost described as like the like grittiness slash like the leftover kind of almost of the wine. And so it's what carries your wine flavors. So if it has like big, bold flavors, that's when you know a wine has some really good tannins to it. It's hard to describe really, honestly. You just kind of like know if it has it or if it doesn't. But if I think once you drink this one and then compare it to other wines, I think that you will know exactly what we're like, you know, what a tannin is and by association, if that makes any sense.
No, I think that's perfect. So I guess from what I'm understanding is it's almost like the intensity of the wine, how like the lingering effect of it.
Correct.
Lots of tannins.
Right.
Because I would say this, like you described it, this has some tannins in it. Because I'm tasting, I'm super sensitive to like peppery flavors. Oh my gosh, I love the way that sounds. Yes.
Yes.
So I love a good peppery, I mean, I think kale is really peppery. You know, a good Coke Zero's got some good peppery vibes to it. Mm-hmm. This also, I'm loving the pepper in it. Like, I feel like I'm getting that kind of, it's almost like the harshness of flavor. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it, this does have some real silky tannins, by the way. But peppery, it does actually, it kind of gives a little like cola, actually, now that I think about it.
That's what I'm saying.
When you say
yes.
That, yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's kind of got this very, in my opinion, this very sharp flavor, almost like that vibe you get from the carbonation of a dark soda.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of like the plum that's coming out.
I could see that.
Because I'm not really getting a whole lot of blackberry or raspberry, but I'm getting a whole lot of plum, and it's very full bodied. And that silky tannins, I'm getting that all the way through the back of the mouth. And a lingering finish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you say full bodied, it's like, so there's definitely a start, a middle, and an ending to the experience of it.
Right.
I mean, it definitely stays the tongue. There's several levels of experience there.
Yeah.
And what I love about this the most is it's called Beber Sin Dormir, which Spanish was my minor in college.
Ooh, I love that.
I don't think you knew this, but because that means to live without sleeping.
Yes.
And I feel like that's been my life. And I was like, correct. I don't know if he knew this about me, but the past several years, it's been sleepless nights and just like, you know, doing the dang thing and getting it out there. And so.
Well, that's what happens when you're a badass businesswoman. So.
Listen, exactly. So that's what I honestly feel like the flavor totally vibes with the name, which is just like out there. It's bold. It's fun. Yeah. And it's like, it's got an opinion almost.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it does. That's a good way to describe. Oh, see, I think you have a future as a sommelier. I love that.
I love it.
It has an opinion. It does. It gives you like very like sure of itself 100%.
Yes.
And I love because when I think of like Vivir Sin Dormir, right? Like I think of just being able to like sleep for certain people, right? Like people like us, frankly, like sleep holds you back, right? Like I love my sleep, to be clear, but like sleep, like in order, if you want to like live life to the absolute fullest, like who wants to sleep for 8 hours? You know what I mean?
So it's
like you have to. And so point being is that like that's what I kind of think of is just like this really big like lively like living life to the absolute fullest, and that's this wine because it's giving me like a really enjoyable experience, but it's also like it just screams, it has an opinion, it screams to somebody, it feels like, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's super bold. I think it does feel like more party vibe. Mm-hmm. It's not very mild. It's not, it's not just gonna sit there. It's not gonna be a wallflower. Like it's going to have a party. I love it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, talking of a very lively situation, this wine, I feel like is parlaying very, very well into the case we're talking about. We have, Megan, an incredibly lively case. It is an infamous situation that, you know, again, all true crime lovers have at least heard of at some point. And so you want to talk about it because we have a lot to talk about. And I mean a lot.
Girl, I'm so ready because I made my pour when I made this glass.
Yeah.
Was insane. So I'm ready. I'm ready for this big, long case.
Excellent. Well, I hope you have the rest of the bottle handy because I think you're probably going to need it for sure.
Very much. But yes.
This week, I'm going to tell you a story about perseverance, Megan. One mother's mission to find her son uncovers a massive conspiracy that stretches far beyond the small suburban town where her whole life was stolen right from her grasp. This week, I want to tell you the story of Johnny Ghosh, the boy on the milk carton. In 1982, the Ghosh family was a really typical American family. They had well settled into their West Des Moines suburban neighborhood. Noreen Ghosh had already been through a lot in her life, too. She had lost her home in a tornado a few years earlier, and her first husband had died of cancer in 1965. She remarried, though. She married John Gosch, and in 1969, she welcomed her sweet little boy, Johnny Gosch. Johnny was a special boy. His sister would often drive him to the mall after school, where he would spend the money he earned as a local paper boy to buy supplies for model rockets, which he absolutely was obsessed with. And if he had money left after that, he would go to the flower store in the mall and buy his mother a single rose. When he got back to the house, he would walk up to Noreen with the rose behind his back and pull it out to say, "I got this for you, Mom." A pure and genuine, just absolute sweetheart. My heart's melting, y'all. Johnny was also known around the neighborhood as being a really good kid. Not only was he known as the neighborhood paper boy, but he was also known as the kid who stood up to the neighborhood bullies. At least once, as neighbors would later tell Johnny's mother, Noreen, Johnny had decided to stand up to four boys in the neighborhood who liked to steal and smash lunchboxes belonging to some of the smaller kids in the block. Johnny didn't like that, and he knocked the bullies down and walked the younger boys home afterwards.
Stop. Okay, so first of all, did you know that I'm from Missouri? Like Tornado Alley, Missouri?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think I did. I think so.
We're just going to pretend like you did, because I feel like I definitely identify with where this is coming from a Midwest standpoint. So my home specifically was never lost in a tornado, but we had several tornadoes, like I said, growing up in Tornado Alley. And it's like, yeah, you lose everything and then you start over and then you marry a great guy. Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah.
And then this little kid, oh my God, are you serious?
I know.
A rose to your mom?
I know, he's the best. Well, and that's, like, exactly who you want to raise, right? Like, that is exactly what every mother says, like, they are going to do. And it just must feel, like, so accomplishing to, like, know that you did that and, like, to, like, you know, to find out. And, like, to be clear, like unfortunately, I suppose, like, she finds out about this, like, after everything that we're about to tell, that I'm about to tell you about Megan. And so, like, kind of unfortunate that she, like, didn't know this was happening, like actively. But like, imagine though, like finding that out like, you know, that this had happened. And like, just, I can't imagine how proud or like, you know, how accomplished that must feel as a mom. 'Cause that's all you want, right? Like all you want is to like, feel like you did a good job as a mother. And like, that feels like the best job in my opinion.
Oh my gosh. No, I agree. And so this is coming from two people without children, but yes, I agree. I think that the most rewarding thing as a parent has got to be that you raise a productive, beautiful member of society. And
absolutely,
you know, and I think we all remember growing up. I mean, I don't think anybody would probably ever, because of the way our brains work, probably would never identify as a bully in high school, but I can remember interacting with bullies and then also sticking up for people who were being bullied. And so so part of me is also going back and being in his shoes as well and being like, my God, like the courage it takes as a little kid to stand up to bullies and the hierarchy of school and friends and all of that stuff. Like what a great little kid. I'm so proud of him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and the peer pressure must be hard too, right? Like, so again, it takes an extra amount of, you know, like guts to stand up with, even with that in mind as well. But so now that we know a little bit about Johnny, though, let's kind of get into a less than good day in Johnny's life.
Okay.
Right. So that's September 5th, 1962. It was a warm, sunny day on a Sunday. Dawn had only just barely arrived as the sun had only barely started to light the roads in West Des Moines, Iowa. It was just before 6 in the morning when Johnny Gosch put on his white sweatshirt with Kim's Academy on the back, throwback, his warm-up pants, blue rubber flip-flops, and grabbed his yellow paper bag to get on his route. Johnny had been working as a delivery boy for the Des Moines Register for a while now, and this was part of the routine. His dad, John, usually joined Johnny on his route to keep an eye on him and to keep him company too. But according to the website Iowa Cold Cases, this morning John decided not to join Johnny for one reason or another. And to my understanding, that happened, you know, it kind of frequently, infrequently, whatever. It wasn't like that out of the ordinary. Johnny left his house with his little dachshund Gretchen, grabbed his wagon that he used to deliver his papers, and took off on his route. Neighbors confirmed that they heard the wagon rattling through their front yard around the same time, and they assumed that it was Johnny taking his usual shortcut on his way to pick up his newspapers for the day. Just a short while later, other paper boys reported that they saw Johnny at the newspaper pickup site, confirming that Johnny did indeed make it there. But they also reported a concerning event that had taken place next. Those paper boys said they saw a blue car pull up to Johnny and saw him talking to the guy inside of it. They talked for a little bit. The witnesses said they assumed that the man was asking Johnny for directions, and then Johnny just started to walk away. Once he did that, the witnesses reported seeing the man inside the blue car flick the dome light on and off 3 times before driving away. Johnny then had walked up to another paper boy and apparently said that he was scared and that he was going to take the papers he had collected and he was going to go home. But as Johnny started walking down the street, they noticed a very tall man walking behind him, possibly following Johnny down the street. The witnesses said he was a white man in his 30s or so, possibly had a mustache and had a somewhat dark complexion too. Johnny turned down another street and at least 2 other witnesses reported seeing him walking down that street pulling his wagon. And one of those witnesses also said that he had at one point stopped pulling the wagon and sat down. But not very long after the witnesses had seen this, other couriers said that they had done their loops and walked down that same street where Johnny had been just seen previously. And they saw Johnny's wagon filled with the paper he had just picked up, but Johnny was nowhere to be seen.
Stop. Okay, so first of all, can I just tell you that this is like my daily struggle of the smallest decisions, because this is what right. You said in terms of, what was it, his dad deciding his dad. Mm-hmm. Not to join him for whatever reason, which is like semi-frequent yeah. as an occurrence. Like, sure. That's the scariest thing is like, what if this one small decision that I make affects the rest of my life and something horrible happens? And I'm talking about like literally on the way to work. Do I take a right or do I take a left? They'll both get me there at the same time kind of thing. And you just think, oh, so this, it's just like coming from the perspective of his father. It's just like, oh my gosh, that one decision. What could he have done?
Yeah. Well, and I just like can't even imagine what he must be feeling like all these years later. Like, it's just heartbreaking, like, honestly. And so I can't even bring myself there
right?
because I imagine you can just go in circles and circles and circles and circles. But then also too, I mean, again, so he seemed to have enough sense to say, to think that something was wrong because of the comments he was making to other paper boys. And so to me, it's also like, why, like all those people could have said something at some point. But again, like, we're talking about all this in hindsight 40 years later, but like, man.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. So I have a history in food retail for years, and it's like people say creepy things and nothing ever comes
right.
from
that's
it. And you can't take like the maximum action every time. And so, but you do always have that thought like, ugh, is this like that
right.
one guy who's just like a little bit too weird?
Yeah.
But oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, and like, again, so here I'll get on my soapbox here, probably not for the last time on this episode, but my little soapbox that I'm going to get on right now is like, see something, say something, y'all, like seriously, because like literally, and I probably take this a little bit too seriously. Like I, the other day was driving in downtown Chattanooga and like saw this guy that was like walking a little too closely to this woman. And like, I called 911. And so like, but like point being, so like, listen, like, I hope everything's fine in that situation. I see Megan's face, but like, I like debated in my mind. I was like, if this is nothing, this is nothing. But if this is something and I don't do anything, then like I will never be able to live with myself. You know what I mean? And so I was just like, I made the call. I was like, the worst thing that happens is someone shows up and like it's nothing and everyone just goes about their day.
Listen, so this is why I know you commented on my face and this is an audio medium. But let me tell you, the reason for my face is because like growing up, and I'm talking like 7, 8, 9 years old, it's like so my short-term memory is insane. And it's because every time we would drive somewhere, I would memorize all of the license plate numbers in front of me
oh, wow.
and what the cars look like, because I was like, oh my gosh, well, you know, if something happens and somebody's like, well, you know, a black sedan was driving on, you know, this street at this time. It's like, well,
Megan's going to be prepared.
I already know the license plate number. So it's so funny you say that, because it's like this worst case scenario, like catastrophizing in my mind since I was like 8 years old. So I haven't I haven't called 911 on a stranger before. I've called 911 because we needed it. But I haven't called 911 on a stranger before, but I'm down. I'm with it. If you see something, say something, especially if that something has a mustache all the time.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's fair. Liz, my new thing is, again, with the amount of crime cases that I've covered in my career and on this podcast, it's like if I see someone in a store with sunglasses and a hat on, I'm 100% calling the police on you, because why do they always do that? But that's a different story, I think, probably. But the point being and all that is that like if something doesn't feel right to you, it's probably not right, right? I mean, really, like, or at least it could not be right. And so point being, like, this was clearly a situation. Again, obviously, we're talking about this podcast, so, like, in hindsight, it was clearly a situation. But, like, in the moment, it felt like it was clearly a situation that someone needed to step in. So, anyways, I guess it was mostly kids, and so, like, I give it that, but, like, it hurts me.
I mean, fair. Okay, so what happened?
Okay, well, witnesses around the area, Megan, also later reported to police that they had looked out their windows to see what may have been a silver and black Ford running a stop sign and turning onto the same street as the paper pickup site, but in the opposite direction toward the interstate. And just less than 2 hours after Johnny left his house that morning, the Gauches start to get calls from their neighbors complaining that they hadn't received their morning paper from Johnny as they always had, and they were wondering where Johnny was that morning. Well, very skeptical by this news, John started to get worried for his son. So he leaves the house to go walk Johnny's normal route to see if he can find where Johnny had gone. And by 7:45 that morning, Johnny's father had come across his son's wagon, filled with every single paper that he was expected to deliver that morning, but there was no Johnny.
Okay, several things now. One, you said conspiracy and my ears perked, and I think we're getting to it, because you said that guy after he left talking to Johnny and he like flashed his his whatever dashboard light or whatever three times. I mean, this is all of the stories that we heard, you and I and our generation growing up. And I think it's a little less common now in terms of like literally, and I don't know the story. And so I'm assuming he gets snatched off the street. This is a story that is all based on the conspiracy, the very, very premeditated, well thought out scenario of how we get this person in our car. Oh my gosh. I don't want to know what happens, but I totally do. Tell me what happens.
Yeah. Well, so, and again, going back to like the dashboard thing or the, you know, dome light thing, that was clearly a situation, like that was clearly a signaling, right?
Right.
So going back to the conspiracy, which like, by the way, this is not what even I was talking about when it came to the conspiracy.
Oh, okay.
So like there's something, no, but there's like, but there's you're onto something for sure. There's more. Okay. And so that's what I'm trying to put on there. But like point being is like, but to what you were saying, Megan, like you're talking about at least two different people here, maybe even a third, if we're talking about a driver, like there's so many, like, we're talking about two different cars, plus a guy who's falling down the road. And so, point being is, like, we're talking about at least two different people, maybe even a third. And so, there's a lot going on here, for sure. But, you know, John delivered the rest of the papers for his son after getting in contact with his wife to tell her what he had found. Noreen immediately called police, who arrived just a little while later to talk to Noreen and John about what had happened. And when they arrived, Johnny's parents told them what they knew about what had happened in just a few short hours on what was otherwise a perfectly normal Sunday morning. But they were a bit caught off guard by the officer's response, Megan. The officer asked if Johnny had ever run away before, to which Noreen and John replied, no, of course not. And they made clear that they felt it was so freaking obvious that he didn't run away this time either. But officers pushed back and insisted that they wait 72 hours before officially filing a missing persons report.
No. Wait, how old was he?
12 years old.
Stop. Okay, listen. I mean, even if he did run away at 12, I mean, let's still go find him. He's 12.
Right. Well, and again, this is, like, ludicrous thinking about this now, right, obviously. And so, because, like, now, like, a child, like, anyone under the age of 18 goes missing and, like, they immediately send out Amber Alerts, all this stuff. None of that existed back in the 80s. And so, like, all these, you know, protocols in place, like, it just, like, these kind of things didn't happen. And so, like, they didn't have protocols in place. And so it was just kind of just like, oh, another runaway. Like, you know, that was the mentality. And so that's kind of what they were getting. But, like, again, obviously everyone knows how much I hate about the 24-hour rule. 72-hour rule makes me want to throw my hand through a wall, but like, especially when you're talking about a 12-year-old, and to talk about a 12-year-old where these are the circumstances that we're talking about here.
Right. Okay, so did they actually have to wait 72 hours?
Yeah, they did. Stop. Megan. And with no Amber Alerts or missing children organizations or DNA databases at the Gauches' disposal in 1982, they felt pretty much on their own without the help of their local law enforcement agency. But they did have the help of their neighbors and community members, and volunteers had searched the woods and fields for Johnny. And that was when John and Noreen started hearing about just how alone they were when it came to the investigative agencies that were supposed to be leading the charge in the search for their son. Some volunteers on this search told Johnny's parents later that the chief of police went out to this search and had made a comment to some of the volunteers suggesting that they all just go home because, quote, the kid is probably just another damn runaway.
Wait, so he said this after the 72 hours had passed, right?
No. This was okay. Very much so during that time period, but volunteers okay. have already come together. Oh. So this is all happening very, very quickly.
So he's trying to disperse volunteers coming.
Correct.
Stop. Right.
Again, off of an assumption, like you don't have anything, you have nothing to base that off of. Like he's never run away before. Like he was in the middle of doing his job. He was a good kid. Like there's no reason for that.
Stop. Also, it's like these are volunteers. Like, I don't know. Give them a kudos and a pat on the back. Yeah.
Just let them do it. Yeah.
Tell them what to do and where to go and what you would do in that situation. Even if you can't, like, from a department standpoint, go anywhere with it. Maybe this is their policy, the 72 hours. But holy guacamole, just the shade. Yeah. Like that passive aggressive comment.
Right.
Mm-mm, I'm not here for it.
A little more than passive aggressive in my opinion. But,
aggressive.
More aggressive. But, you know, the comment felt even more chilling, Megan, when the Gauchos started hearing about a questionable record that the police chief had. One that would reinforce their theory that they really couldn't trust the people that they should be entrusting with their son's life. And as they learned more about their local police department, Noreen couldn't help but think about something that had happened with Johnny just 2 days before he disappeared. Crime Over Wine is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone who's used therapy for years, I know that finding a therapist can sometimes be a stress on its own, juggling your full-time job, your family, your friends, your podcast, and trying to find the right therapist on top of that can almost feel impossible. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp matches you with a therapist that works for you on your terms. It's online, it's remote, and by filling out a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to one of 33,000 licensed professional therapists in as little as a few days. And because finding a new therapist is a lot like finding a new bottle of wine, if you don't jive with your therapist, you can easily switch to a new one at no additional cost. You can get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by going to BetterHelp.com/crimeoverwine. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crimeoverwine for 10% off your first month. Join over 4 million people who decided to get help and get happy with BetterHelp. On September 3rd, 1982, the Gauch family was attending Johnny's older brother's JV football game. This was just 2 days before Johnny disappeared. It was Friday Night Lights in Iowa. The entire town was out to watch this high school football game. At some point early on in the game, Johnny tells his parents he wanted to go to the concession stand to get some popcorn. But after a little while, John realizes that Johnny was gone just a little bit too long, and John goes to look for him. After a few minutes, John finds Johnny under the bleachers talking to a police officer. Now, when John approaches them to ask what was going on, Johnny didn't really seem too upset about the whole situation, and the officer just ends up, you know, saying hey and walking away. And Johnny tells his dad that the officer was, like, a nice guy. He had called for Johnny from underneath the bleachers where the officer said he wanted to have a private conversation. But Johnny didn't really elaborate much on what that conversation was. And when his parents asked him about why he listened to the officer and went under the bleachers with him, Johnny responded, quote, "He's a police officer. Don't you have to do what he says?"
Oof. Man, this is tough because I do, like, for anybody who knows me, I do love a good process and procedure, and I love rules. And my first assumption is that a rule is there to protect everybody, and, you know, same with authority. And I know that is an easy thing for me to say coming from where I come from, but holy guacamole, do we know, are you about to tell me kind of like who this police officer is and how he plays into things, or is he just a rando?
Kinda. So let's get there, because I think you'll have a lot more information and clarity around that.
Okay, perfect. I'll have opinions like this wine.
Yes, for sure. On the way out of the game that night, Johnny pointed the police officer out to his parents, and Noreen made a mental image of this officer.
Okay, Noreen is like, Noreen's my girl. Like, this is the license plate version, the human license plate version. I'm a fan.
Yeah, Noreen doesn't mess around. Noreen's a badass crime mom for sure, 100%.
Okay, perfect.
So, yeah, and it gets even better. And so after Johnny had disappeared just a couple days later, Noreen approached the chief of police and asked for pictures of officers who had been hired to work security at the game so she could identify the officer who had oddly been speaking to her son under the bleachers of all places less than 48 hours before he had mysteriously vanished. When the chief laid out the pictures of the officers on staff who may have been at the game that night, one of the pictures stood out right away as the officer who Johnny had pointed out at the football game. But when Noreen had confronted the chief about it and demanded she be able to question him about what he had said to Johnny at the game and about his disappearance, the chief apparently threw just an absolute fit and started yelling and started stomping his feet, protesting Noreen's accusations about one of his officers' possible, even far-fetched involvement in Johnny's disappearance.
Okay, I mean, methinks thou dost protest too much. Yeah. Is this one of those situations, though?
Well, I mean, kind of. I don't know. It just seems like an obvious, like, connection to me, right? Because it's like you, like, the like weird thing happens, and then even weirder thing happens, right? Like, a couple days later. And it's like,
exactly.
Like, you know, like, if one of those things had happened in your life, you would be like, that's weird. And so the fact that they happened to both of those things happened in such close contact, it feels like a natural explanation. And especially, again, because remember what Johnny had originally said about, oh, why'd you go along with him? Oh, well, he's a police officer. You're supposed to do what he says. And so, like, point being is that, like, that seems like a good way to get a kid to come with you so you can steal him. Again, hypothetically speaking, I'm not, like, this officer, again, is not accused of a crime at this point, necessarily, like, formally anyways. And so, like that seems, that's just, like, Johnny seems like the type of kid that, like, if a police officer came, like, with bad intentions and, like, told him to get in the car, he would listen, because clearly that's what he did.
Oh, totally. I mean, this guy was, for some reason, using his authority to get Johnny to come over for a conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's
even if it
what
was innocent.
I'm...
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So that's what I'm interested in. But okay, so this is my question. You talked about how this chief of police, he had a questionable record. And so I want to put those two things together. So what do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. Wait till you hear about this, Megan.
Okay.
And to be clear, Noreen had actually found out about everything I'm about to tell you a while after Johnny's disappearance and well after Noreen had been in the room with this police chief. She did not know any of this at the time. But the chief's name was Orville Cooney. And he had a really interesting history that included a criminal record.
Is that possible to have a criminal record as a police chief?
So, if you're a minor, yes, because a lot of that, you can get that expunged and that doesn't get on your record, and then basically as though it doesn't happen.
Okay, and perfect.
He was a minor at the time.
Okay.
And on February 27th, 1951, the Des Moines Register reported that he had taken a young boy for a ride and severely beat him with four other boys when he was just 17. Chief Cooney later pleaded guilty to assault with intent to inflict great bodily injury, which landed him 30 days in jail. After he got out, he decided to enlist in the Marines, and once he got out of the military, he chose a career in law enforcement. In 1968, Orville joined the West Des Moines Police Department, and just 8 years later, he was hired as the police chief. But the chief's complicated history didn't end there. In 1982, after Johnny's disappearance, the Des Moines Register reported on some really troubling behavior by the chief. The paper had interviewed 18 different anonymous employees with the West Des Moines Police Department, including 14 of the 20 patrol officers who worked for the agency at the time. Now, the accusations these employees make are troubling. They make all sorts of accusations against the chief in these conversations with reporters. The employees say that the chief had allegedly beaten a handcuffed prisoner at one point, compromised a burglary investigation that may have involved one of the chief's sons, and threatened and harassed his own officers on a regular basis. Again, those are three totally different accusations in at least three different situations. The employees also say the chief had smelled of alcohol many times, and they had seen beer cans in the cars that he had used, at least once when the chief was on the street checking on his officer at night. The chief was also quoted by the employees as saying that he would never hire a black person or a woman as an officer, and he was reported to have been saying the N-word multiple times. Now, the city of West Des Moines had apparently been aware of the accusations because as part of this story by the Des Moines Register, reporters detailed an investigation that had taken place by the city into the accusations, where the city had found no wrongdoing by the chief of police, but instead found wrongdoing by some of the whistleblowers. Two officers were fired and several others were reprimanded for reasons that were apparently, according to this investigation, totally unrelated to the accusations against the police chief.
Stop it. Okay. So I feel like at this point we're hearing a very typical story of a person in authority in what is this, the 60s and the 70s?
Right.
All right. We're not gonna hire black people. We're not gonna hire women.
Right.
Oh. Right. Okay. Yeah. And so I mean, not that one is related to the other, but holy guacamole, kind of like this thought process down the line of abusing authority and then having these lower opinions of other people. Oh my gosh, I am so interested. And Noreen's a freaking badass.
Yeah.
So when does she find this out in the process? You said she'd already been kind of in the room, like she was at some point within this process that she found this out about him.
Right. So this was months later after Johnny's disappearance. So this, she had already kind of given up on the police department because she had already seen that they just weren't really interested in investigating it. Like, you know, had all these assumptions made about Johnny. And so she had already kind of given up on that this was not going to be a thorough investigation.
So that is critical time that she lost.
Right.
That she could have been taking things into her own hands if she knew that this wasn't going to be handled correctly.
Correct. Right. Oh, and she had already, and we're about to get into it, but she had already kind of launched her own investigation, hired her own private investigator. But still, I mean, the police department has access to so many more things than a PI. And so, so it's just kind of, and again, you shouldn't have to do that, in my opinion, obviously. I mean, you should be able to trust your local police to investigate everything, thoroughly. And I also have to say, disclaimer here. The chief has never been formally, accused of having anything to do with Johnny's disappearance in any way, shape, or form, just to be crystal clear. But and also too, I have to say, a racist and a sexist is not a child abductor make, right? Those two things do not have to equal each other. But I do have to say that poor behavior, makes sense in the back end of this whole thing when we're talking about, improper investigations, etc.
Yeah, and this it just sucks because this is a familiar story. I feel like we hear it, a different iteration of it in modern times, and just this is where it comes from, and this is why people are sick of hearing these stories, is because we've been hearing them for literally decades.
Right. Well, and I also have to say too, because again, we're going back to the conspiracy part of this whole thing, where it's you also have a man who clearly has. Again, it seems pretty black and white to me that all these people, 18 different people didn't just make all this up, and yet, he didn't do anything wrong, according to this investigation. And so, point being is he clearly has connections, and clearly has influence. And so, I'm not surprised that Noreen saw this and said, of course this is how this is happening, because this is the guy who's in charge of it.
Yeah, well, because she's smart and she's a badass. So,
correct.
Tell me more.
Yes. Well, this had obviously given Noreen and John reason to side-eye this entire investigation and to further emphasize their distrust for their local law enforcement agency. And so, as a result, the family hired their own private investigator, like we said, and started their own parallel investigation to the official police investigation. And they had distributed an estimated more than 10,000 posters with their son's face on them. And as years went by, Megan, with no real sign of Johnny, he was featured as the first of the so-called milk carton kids. He, along with two other boys who went missing from the greater Des Moines area in 1984 and 1986, 2 and 4 years after Johnny, respectively, were put onto the milk cartons with the help of local dairy farmers in the hope that families would be sitting around the kitchen table having breakfast and would see their faces and would be more likely to come forward if they had information about them.
Stop. So this is the origin of that practice.
Correct. Yeah. And so this started that, and then it became a nationwide trend as a result.
Oh my gosh.
And so the other two kids as well, the kids who went missing from the mm-hmm. area after Johnny, those were not believed to be connected to Johnny in any way, at least according to the investigative agencies. And so keep that in mind as well. So there was the second young boy, Eugene Martin, was actually the first boy. His family was connected to this local dairy farmer, and so they kind of made the whole thing happen. But Johnny gotcha. Was like the first one that they put together because of the high profile nature of the case, and so they put him on there alongside Eugene.
Oh my gosh, how interesting. I mean, a little bit of history, which is so sad, but yeah, I also learned right. a little bit.
Yeah, there you go. Well, in the years after Johnny's disappearance, Noreen never gave up on finding Johnny. She left the porch light on their home so that Johnny would know he was still welcome home mm-hmm. even after all these years. And that was Noreen's life. Dreams of Johnny walking up to the front door and him finding his way home to her arms. Still, that 12-year-old little boy who wandered off in that warm September morning. It was hard for her to imagine Johnny as anything other than that 12-year-old little boy, even though she knew subconsciously that he had grown up significantly since she had last seen him. It was just too hard for her to imagine him as anything other than her little Johnny. But there were some moments of hope for Noreen and John. On February 22nd, 1984, the phone rang at the Ghosh home, as it had so many times before, only this time the person on the other side of the phone said, "Mom?" And Noreen could have sworn it sounded just like Johnny. He was asking for help, but his words were slurred, and he wasn't understandable. She asked him where he was, but then he hung up, and the call was untraceable, and it was never okay. confirmed whether or not it was actually Johnny.
I mean, so this is my thing. I get so irrationally enraged when we're talking about cold cases, and then people take that as an opportunity to, right. play a joke on the police or something like that. I mean, you're like playing with people's emotions. Like, this right. is the thing about a disappearance, especially of a child, like the right. lack of closure.
Right.
Like, right. It's hard. It's hard if your child dies. But can you imagine just that inkling of hope
right,
that
right,
that's
right.
not the case? And then to just take advantage of it in what is probably a joke. Or something yeah. like that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I can't. The jokesters.
Yeah. Well, and to be clear, I do lean 60% in the direction this is probably not Johnny, but I think there's a solid 40% of me after researching
really?
This that says that it may be him. And again, we're going to get into a whole lot of things much later on. But there's there's a lot to be said here for sure that we may have to revisit at some point. But I am, point being is I'm not totally it definitely hasn't been confirmed that it's not him. I'll put it that
okay.
way.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll take it. So something else that just coming from the perspective of his mother, can you imagine even if it makes sense for you to move, no, I'm never moving. What if
yeah,
Johnny
yeah.
comes
right,
home?
Right.
You know,
right.
Even if it's just redecorating his room, no, I'm not going to redecorate it. What if Johnny
yeah.
comes home?
Right.
There's a part of you that is just frozen in time
yeah.
because what
yeah.
if Johnny comes home? Oh
right,
my gosh.
Exactly.
Can you imagine? Again, the lack of closure, but then also just this, this mental image of
yeah.
what if Johnny comes home? What is he going
right.
to think?
Right.
Ugh, because you can't give up hope at that
no.
point.
Yeah.
Ugh,
yeah.
Liam.
No, it's complicated. Yeah, I know. I feel you. This was literally you just expressed all the emotions that I had while I was researching this whole case. Because it's, and Megan, just hold on. That's all I have to say because it gets so much more encapsulating. So yeah.
Oh my gosh. Are you going to toy with my emotions?
Yes. Yeah. Well, so there were some possible sightings also of Johnny and Megan that investigators actually believe may have been credible. 6 months after Johnny's disappearance, a woman reported seeing a boy on a street corner in Oklahoma. The boy approached her out of breath saying, quote, "My name is John David Ghosh." But before she could learn anything more about him, the two men grabbed him and dragged him away. The woman was unaware, apparently, of Johnny's disappearance until months later when she saw his face on TV, and that was when she called the private investigator the Ghosh family had hired, and the private investigator later said publicly that he was convinced that it was actually Johnny. In March 1984, too, investigators say a boy who looks like Johnny was seen in Texas, and an investigator at the local sheriff's office in Texas believed the reported sighting enough to say that they believe Johnny is, quote, alive and could be found. In July 1985, a woman in Sioux City, Iowa, got a dollar bill with her change in a grocery store, and written on the bill said, "I am alive," with Johnny's signature on it. And three separate handwriting analysts, get this, Megan, reported that the note on the bill was indeed likely Johnny's.
Stop. Okay, but so this is my question. Like, what is the point in keeping him alive? Like, I mean, generally there's a purpose in abducting a child. So yeah. Why are we going to keep him alive? So that's my only, like, I guess that's my only comment on these sightings, which a lot of times are debunked, but it sounds like in this situation actually has some potential validity to them. But like, why? And are you going to tell me this? Are we going to need to edit this out because I'm going to look dumb?
No, you know, you're definitely not going to look dumb, but I promise you, you're not going to like the answer, for sure. But you are going to find out, unfortunately. But I also have to say about this, like, sighting of him in Oklahoma, like, it just, again, see something, say something, right? Like, we've talked about this before, but, like, the fact, like, you're telling, like, a child comes up to you and says, you know, whatever he says to you, and then two men drag him away, at least, like, according to you, and, like, that just doesn't, you know, strike a nerve. It doesn't, you know, come off as suspicious or odd enough to, like, call somebody, like, right away until you, like, see him, like, which, like, I don't know, whatever. I don't know all the circumstances. Like, it was surely dramatized, like, you know, more elaborate than maybe what it seemed like, I would imagine. But that is weird to me that it's months later before you call.
No, I agree. But you also have to think that you're coming from a 2024 standpoint. Mm. And this is back, what, in the 80s when it was like a you do you in your own home kind of thing?
Yeah. Right.
And so and that's why I think that some of these crimes are so they weren't reported and things that would never fly now.
That's because
we're kind of so with social media and things like that. We're so used to being in each other's business to see something, say something, like you've referenced several times.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like we've seen the playbook a lot of these criminals. And so I don't think this would fly. I don't think Johnny would be abducted in 2024. But this is the reason why Johnny wouldn't be abducted, is because he is a cautionary tale in terms of all of these things that were overlooked. And so you just got to remember that we're talking, what, 1980s or something? Like, oof.
Yeah. And it's hard like not to like look at it from obviously from a 2024 perspective, because I wasn't back then I wasn't alive back in 1994. And so point being is that like there is like you it's easy to like look at it from like a perspective of like, you know, where TikTok, when like, you know, Johnny's face would immediately be on like all the TikTok feeds.
Totally.
Like,
yes.
And so like he would definitely be a household name today, 100% if he went missing in 2024. I don't know. I just also, but like, it's just hard for me to imagine that, like, that a child, like two men grab a child and drag them away from you after they're trying to speak to you. And like that, it's just, that doesn't seem odd, but like, I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking way too much into it. Again, I'm thinking about like in a crime brain for sure. And like, obviously if she knew, then like she would have said something, but I don't know.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. This is also your reporter brain that's working. Correct. In terms of like, what are all the angles? And a lot of times people don't want any unnecessary drama in their life. Now, this is coming from, this is me on the outside of that assessment, because I love me some reality shows. I'm a housewife girl. Right. I do love some drama. So I will for sure create any kind of like backstory to a situation like that. But a lot of people are not like us, Liam, and they don't want the drama, and they're not willing to call 911 on random strangers. And so maybe she had so much going on, she just did not want police in her life right now.
That's fair. No, that's fair. I can totally see that. But like, you know, whatever ended up happening because of all that, you know, none of these sightings got investigators any closer to finding Johnny, Megan. That was until 1991, almost 10 years after Johnny disappeared during his paper route. That was when a man came forward with firsthand information related to Johnny's disappearance, and he claimed to be one of the kidnappers. Now, y'all, As if this story couldn't get any more intense, the second half is even more unbelievable than the first. The stories and developments Megan and I are going to tell you all about will leave you wondering if what we know about this case so far is all true, or maybe you believe what a lot of people are saying about this case and insist that someone out there must be pulling the strings. Now, don't hate me, but there is just too much to talk about when it comes to Johnny Gosch to fit into just one episode, but I promise you, you won't want to miss part two on the Johnny Gosch case, which will air next Wine Wednesday on the next episode of Crime Over Wine.
Proud member of the Podnougan Network.